Deep in the abandoned archives of a fantasy city, there is an immortal undead wizard torturing a man in a cage.
Right, but he isn't demanding gold or, you know, magical secrets.
Exactly. He's just beating the cage with a steel rod, screaming at the top of his lungs. Is the sentence a lie?
It's completely wild.
It really is. So, welcome to today's deep dive. Our mission today is exploring this truly fascinating stack of source material we got our hands on.
Yeah, specifically, it's the session transcripts from the first six games of a homebrewed tabletop role-playing campaign.
And we really want to be clear with you right up front. We aren't here to aggrandize or, like, oversell this campaign material.
No, not at all. We're just here to recap the events of the most recent session, which is Game 6, titled Hobnail Prison.
But what makes this specific session so compelling to dig into is how the Dungeon Master masterfully weaves these running meta-jokes.
Oh, the meta-jokes are great.
Right. Past encounters and these incredibly abstract logic puzzles directly into this super gritty political plot.
Yeah, and to really understand how this world operates, you kind of have to look at the characters navigating it.
Definitely.
We are following a party of five. There is Elgis, who is an exiled noble trying to reclaim his glory. Virgil, an ambidextrous rogue who treats morality as, well, a loose suggestion.
The very loose suggestion.
Right. Then there's Kiltak, a fiercely driven barbarian. Barnaby, a cleric who was essentially drafted by his god. And Hayden, a warlock beholden to this mysterious fey overlord.
So they are currently operating in the city of Holland. And to understand Holland, you really have to look at where the actual power lies.
Yeah, it isn't in a throne room.
No, it's actually on the top floor of the Mooncalf Tavern at Miss Miller's Thursday Night Salon.
And before our party can even think about breaking into a prison, they need information on some missing city officials.
The former masters of revelry.
Exactly. And that objective drops them right into the middle of this lavish top floor apartment. And the guest list reads like a roster of people who actively want to destroy each other.
It's so tense. You have Elgis standing in the exact same room as his estranged father, Garth. The man who literally banished him.
Talk about awkward.
Seriously. Also present are Parja, the Admiralty Secretary, Helmholtz, the Acting Master of Revels, and Holly.
And Holly is the advocate who orchestrated the trial that ousted Garth from the company board.
Right. Being in this room is basically like being forced to attend a holiday dinner where every single guest has recently sued each other.
That is the perfect way to describe it. It's a complete political minefield.
It really is.
Miss Miller's salon is the absolute epicenter of power and information in Holland. You have the people who make the laws, the people who break the laws.
And the people who profit from both.
Exactly. All sipping cocktails together. The tension is palpable because every single conversation is essentially a negotiation or a threat.
So Miss Miller attempts to elevate the evening, you know, to put a lid on the boiling pot by introducing a speaker.
Right, Annie, a mathematician from the Quaternion Society.
And on the surface, this feels like standard world-building fluff. Just a little academic flavor text to make the setting feel lived in.
Yeah, Annie starts discussing her work, which involves translating English paradoxes into this strict new mathematical language.
Created by a missing scholar named Manfred Unger.
Right. But this isn't just flavor text. Annie raises three specific concepts in her presentation that directly anchor to the party's past traumas.
Let's look at the first one. Annie mentions the classic logic puzzle. This sentence is a lie.
Which, to the salon guests swirling their wine, is just a neat little thought experiment.
Right. Because if the sentence is true, then it's a lie, making it false. If it's false, then it's not a lie, making it true.
It just loops endlessly. But to Hayden and the rest of the party listening to this speech...
Oh, the blood absolutely drains from their faces.
Because they immediately remember the events of Game 5.
Yes. When they broke into the abandoned Holland Grimoire and found Ischiel.
An 18th level lich.
And for anyone unfamiliar, an 18th level lich is essentially an immortal, undead god of magic. This is a creature that can warp reality with a whisper.
And what was Ischiel doing?
He was desperately trying to solve this exact paradox. He had a compulsive liar named Mowgli Grillin locked in a cage, just torturing him.
Trying to force a definitive answer to a paradoxical loop.
The contrast is horrifying. A polite academic theory at a cocktail party is simultaneously a matter of eternal torment down in the dark corners of the city.
It's brilliant. Then Annie brings up her second concept, which is the mathematical theory that some true statements can never be proven true within their own system.
Oh man, this connects directly to Game 4, Virgil, our highly skeptical rogue, went to the Cathedral of Gradska.
Right, he stopped at the Chapel of Ajana.
A god he barely even believes in, by the way.
Yeah.
And he prayed. In response, he received a moment of divine enlightenment.
He was given the true name of Ajana.
Yes, and that true name was literally every true statement that can't be proven true.
Which is insane. Virgil received a divine revelation from a god, and that revelation is fundamentally a mathematical theorem that Annie is just now starting to theorize about in a tavern.
It really implies a structural breakdown of the barrier between the divine and the academic.
Absolutely. And it all culminates in the third concept Annie mentions to the salon. She brings up the barber paradox.
I love this part.
It goes like this. Does the barber who shaves everyone who doesn't shave himself shave himself?
Because if he does, he shouldn't. If he doesn't, he must.
Exactly.
And I have to point out the incredible meta joke happening here. Because in previous games, the dungeon master went completely out of their way to interrogate the players about their characters' grooming habits.
Yes. The DM specifically asked if Elges, Barnaby, and Hayden had beards, what their hair looked like.
And most importantly, if they used barbers in the City of Holland.
The players almost certainly thought this was just quirky roleplay, you know, getting them to visualize their characters.
But no, the DM was meticulously laying the groundwork for a mathematical paradox joke sessions in advance.
It shows an impressive level of narrative foresight. But look at the underlying mechanism at play across all three of these examples.
Wait, I'm trying to wrap my head around the mechanics of this world.
Hmm.
Why is a hyperlogical mass presentation happening in a setting where a wizard can shoot fire from their hands?
That's a great question.
I mean, if magic is real, the laws of physics are already broken. Why do the rules of formal logic even matter to an immortal lich?
Well, because magic in this setting might just be a localized manipulation of physics. But formal logic, mathematics, that appears to be the underlying source code of the universe.
Oh, wow.
Right. An 18th level lich has already mastered the physical world. Now they are trying to understand the architectural framework that holds reality together.
That makes so much sense.
So when a lich tries to solve the liar's paradox, they aren't just doing a crossword puzzle. They are trying to divide by zero in the real world. They are trying to hack the source code.
So a paradox is essentially a fatal error in the universe's programming, and powerful entities are using it to break the system.
Exactly.
That is a terrifying implication. But before the party can fully process this, the high-minded academic discussion abruptly ends.
Yeah, the brutal reality of Holland's politics just shatters the intellectual atmosphere.
Parja and Garth literally stand up in the middle of the room and start extorting Ms. Miller right in front of her guests.
The philosophical gives way to the transactional in an instant.
Garth is furious because Ms. Miller's political lobbying network successfully killed a bill that would have protected Nounkeg's iron monopoly.
And Parja is equally enraged because Miss Miller defeated a bill that would have stopped an inventor named Downey from patenting a new gunpowder process.
They're losing money and control, so they threaten her with legislation.
Right. They announce they have written a new law that will ban women from attending banquets.
Which is such a specific, bizarre threat. Banning women from banquets.
It sounds absurd until you realize the Dungeon Master is drawing a direct parallel to real-world history.
Like, really?
Yeah, this is inspired by the sumptuary laws of medieval Venice. In the 1500s, Venetian authorities enacted strict anti-banqueting laws to prevent wealthy noblemen from essentially buying votes and influence at exclusive social clubs.
Oh, I see.
By prohibiting women from attending, the state deliberately tried to make these gatherings less appealing and less socially powerful, cutting down on backroom political influence.
Wow, so grounding a fantasy political squabble in real, historical legislative tactics makes the threat feel incredibly authentic.
It really does. But Miss Miller proves just how cold she is. She doesn't flinch.
No, she just thanks everyone for attending and walks out without conceding a single inch.
And her exit sparks total chaos in the room.
Elges takes the opportunity to rudely shoulder past his father, Garth. Kiltak fakes a trip and completely knocks Garth to the ground.
And Virgil, reading the room perfectly, uses the collision as a distraction to flawlessly pickpocket Garth's wallet.
It's a beautifully executed sequence of petty revenge.
But that stolen wallet instantly becomes the physical bridge to the next phase of the narrative.
Right. Because while the chaos is dying down, Virgil has a quiet side conversation with Helga, the director of the Foundling Gate Orphanage.
And Helga starts by thanking Virgil for a recent anonymous 500 gold donation he made through an apothecary.
Very sweet, very charitable. But then, without missing a beat, She asks Virgil to use his locksmith skills to forge company stock ledgers for a dead man named Ash Turner.
Just a casual felony.
Right. And as if that isn't enough, she casually brings up how much stock Garth holds.
She looks at Virgil and darkly hints that if Garth were to, you know, accidentally die,
his massive stock holdings could somehow be funneled to the orphans.
She is wrapping extortion and plotted murder in the warm, unimpeachable blanket of charity.
Helga is operating like a ruthless corporate raider. She's running an orphanage, but she's talking about leveraging human deaths for voting stock in the Great Council.
It's wild.
It's a hostile takeover disguised as bake sales and baby blankets. Her willingness to leverage a death for stock power proves just how ruthless Holland's elite truly are.
It totally encapsulates the morality of the city. There are no pure altruists.
No. Even the person caring for the city's abandoned children is playing multidimensional chess with people's lives to secure voting power.
And it's exactly that brand of ruthless pragmatism the party adopts next.
Because armed with Garth's freshly stolen wallet, they finally have the tool they need to execute their main objective for the night.
Breaking into Hobnail Prison.
The sheer hubris of their plan is staggering. They are sneaking in alongside Brandy Cranston, who is a spy for the secret police, and a gang leader named Ulrich.
Let's actually break down what they are attempting to do in one night. They plan to rescue Brandy's Uncle Carter from a cell.
Okay, noble enough.
They plan to help Ulrich assassinate his own boss, Lars, because Lars is secretly funding the secret police.
Right.
While they're at it, they plan to assassinate the secret police chief, Durr, to steal a specific amulet.
And the cherry on top. They plan to leave Garth's stolen wallet in the middle of the carnage to frame him for the entire bloodbath.
The plan is less of a tactical strike and more like throwing 5 different lit matches into a fireworks factory and hoping the explosions somehow cancel each other out.
Seriously. To get inside, they use an infiltration route through the Brockhaus Monument, which connects to the underground cisterns beneath the prison.
And the lore they encounter in this monument is just as tangled as their heist plan.
They spend time reading the plaques dedicated to Holbein Brock.
Brock's life story is basically the story of Hollum itself. He started as a street kid. He became a pirate.
He was exiled, turned his penal colony into a functional shipyard.
Was pardoned to become a royal privateer and eventually became King Sturgis's secret paramour.
He built the very shipyards and boom towers that eventually evolved into Hobnail Prison.
So the physical architecture they are sneaking through proves that the lines between criminality and royal authority have always been blurred.
But the monument isn't just a history museum. The party makes some deeply unsettling discoveries as they move through it.
Oh, yeah. Barnaby finds a small chapel dedicated to Gradska. On the chairs inside, there are piles of beige dust.
He inspects the dust closer and finds human fingernails mixed into it.
Just consider the visceral horror of that image. If there are piles of beige dust sitting neatly on chairs and fingernails are the only thing left intact,
it means whoever was sitting there wasn't just killed. Their entire biological structure was instantly pulverized or dehydrated out of existence,
leaving only the keratin behind. It sets an immediate tone of lethal unpredictability.
It really does. Then Virgil visits a chapel to Ajana nearby. He finds a small offering left behind. Green cake, which is a highly valuable, highly illegal narcotic in this world.
And Virgil swaps a gold piece for the drugs, mutters a quick prayer, and says, "To hell with Ajana if Ajana doesn't help."
He feels absolutely nothing in response. Meanwhile, Kiltak wanders into the main dome and finds a toppled stone casket. A skeleton is spilled out of it.
And Kiltak neatly tucks the bones back inside, but notices an arcane compass left behind in the dirt.
A device that points to the planet's arcane poles and the intersection of magical ley lines.
And here, the party shows a remarkable amount of restraint. They look at a highly valuable magical compass sitting next to a dead body in a trapped monument.
And they actively decide to leave it right where it is.
They are learning to respect the lethal nature of their environment. They don't touch it.
They stay focused on the mission. They throw on their disguises. Virgil dresses as a guard. Hayden uses an illusion to look exactly like Garth.
Telgis dresses as a gang member, and Barnaby strips down to look like a scruffy prisoner.
So they descend into the dark, damp cisterns. They pay off Millicent the Rat Queen and her urchin children with a little gold to pass unbothered.
And they finally climb up the rusty, echoing stairs into the North Tower basement of Hobnail Prison.
And this is where the entire narrative fractures.
They are bracing for a highly organized, heavily armed response.
They are expecting a tense, tactical gang war against the secret police inquisitors.
But the reality they step into is entirely wrong.
The heavy iron cell doors are hanging wide open. The heavily armed guards and the hardened prisoners aren't fighting each other.
They aren't even acknowledging the party.
No, they are huddled together on the dry stone floor, deeply dazed and completely deranged.
When Virgil cautiously approaches one of the people on the floor to speak, the person just stares blankly and mumbles, "I was in the water and it was cold. The water was the ocean."
It is so creepy.
Another person on the floor chimes in, completely detached from reality.
"I woke up in the ocean. No, I was born in the ocean."
They start talking about being caught in a mesh of ropes, a net by fishermen.
These are fully grown humans sitting in a dry, landlocked stone basement beneath the city, suffering from the shared delusion that they are deep sea creatures pulled from the abyss.
The tonal whiplash is staggering. It's like buying a ticket to a gritty mafia heist movie where you are fully strapped in for switchblades, corrupt cops, and double crosses.
Right.
And halfway through the second act, the genre suddenly violently flips into Lovecraftian cosmic horror. You're expecting Goodfellas, and the director gives you Cthulhu.
Exactly.
The genius of this transition is how it weaponizes scale. The Dungeon Master used the mundane, earthly greed of politicians fighting over iron monopolies and banquet laws to lull the players.
And us as listeners.
Yeah, into a false sense of security. We thought we understood the stakes.
But when this cosmic, reality-breaking horror arrives, it feels unthinkably vast by comparison.
Whatever psychic, ocean-dwelling force just broke into the secret police's most secure fortress operates on a scale that renders human politics completely irrelevant.
The party pushes deeper into the East Tower basements. Utterly terrified, they find thick brick walls that have been literally blown outward,
yeah,
as if by immense pressure.
And they find a warden's desk covered in highly suspicious letters.
One letter mentions those exact stock buy-ups by nobodies that Helga, the orphanage director, was plotting.
Another letter confirms that Ella, the missing master of revels they've been looking for, was poisoned.
So the political plot hasn't vanished. It's still happening right there in the background.
The mundane corruption is still there, but it is entirely eclipsed by the immediate, terrifying threat in the room with them.
Suddenly, Barnaby and Virgil, who are acting as a rear guard near a massive cannon, are attacked.
But it's not a physical ambush with swords or crossbows?
No, these deranged secret police inquisitors and prisoners unleash a coordinated psychic attack.
It bypasses their armor entirely and feeds directly on the party's minds.
Kiltak fails his mental saves and is brought to the absolute brink of death just from the psychic trauma of the assault.
The party barely survives the encounter. Barnaby is forced to use a massive, desperate healing prayer just to keep them from collapsing into comas.
You were so close.
And pay close attention to the mechanics of that attack. It was a psychic feeding.
Right.
It implies that whatever this ocean entity is, it isn't just physically altering the prison. It is actively consuming the consciousness of the people inside it.
The guards and prisoners aren't just crazy. Their minds are being digested.
Which brings us to the agonizing cliffhanger of Game 6.
The party has survived this horrific psychic ambush. They've healed up, their adrenaline is spiking, and they push forward through the destroyed basement.
They cautiously peer into an interrogation room, and they see a live person strapped to a gurney.
And that is exactly where the Dungeon Master calls the session.
It is a phenomenal place to pause. When you look at the architecture of this entire session, from the salon to the prison, it really is a masterclass in narrative layering.
The ultimate takeaway here isn't just that the game changed genres, it's about how those layers interact.
You have high society squabbles, intricate mathematical paradoxes, petty vendettas over patents,
and sudden terrifying shifts in reality, all existing in the exact same ecosystem.
It shows that in a truly lived-in world, you never really know what's behind the next door.
A simple prison break to forge some documents can instantly become a fight to protect your very sanity from being consumed.
It forces everyone involved to constantly reevaluate the nature of the threat. Is the real danger the corrupt politicians writing laws to ruin their rivals?
Is it the secret police funding street gangs?
Or is it the fundamental laws of reality breaking down underneath their feet?
I want to leave you with a final, lingering question to ponder about this world. We talked earlier about those mathematical paradoxes.
Right, the liar's paradox.
If formal logic like that is currently breaking the minds of immortal reality-warping liches, and an unknown psychic entity from the ocean can instantly shatter the minds of hardened secret police inside a fortress.
Oh, I see where you're going with this.
Is the true villain of this campaign not a monster at all? Could the real enemy they are fighting be the concept of forbidden knowledge itself?
That is a terrifying thought.
Just knowing the wrong truth, whether it's a mathematical equation or a memory of the deep ocean, might be the most lethal trap of all.
It changes how you view every piece of information they uncover moving forward.
Keep questioning the narrative, watch out for the muddy waters, and we will see you next time.